Like the prodigal son's father, Jacob had been looking out for many days, hoping for the return of his 11 sons, including Simeon, who had been jailed in Egypt, but especially Benjamin, his favorite remaining son. And then finally, one day, there they all were. Reuben, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, and Simeon, and even Benjamin. And that day was a massive turning point in the life of the elderly patriarch. That morning, he had the prospect of spending the rest of his few remaining years in sadness, without Joseph, in Canaan, and then with the message with which our text begins, everything's turned on its head. He's going to leave Canaan for Egypt. Happiness illumines his future, because Joseph, whom he thought was dead, is actually alive. It's a turning point for Jacob and a transformation for him. And there are other people who could look back on their lives and say, on that day, whatever it may be, my life changed dramatically. For some people, it's a calamity. That was the day in which I had a debilitating car accident, and my life has never been the same since. Or, I'll never forget the day when I heard from the doctor that I or my spouse had cancer. God never forsakes us. But here, it's one of those turning points that's a positive, a good one, no matter what way you cut it or look at it. This was the best news that Jacob had heard in decades, probably in his whole life. He hadn't had much good news in the last few decades. And this changed the course of all of his remaining days. And so it is that Jacob sets off for Egypt. We're going to look first at the good news about Joseph, and then the night vision at Beersheba. Jacob sets off for Egypt after hearing the good news about Joseph, and then he stops off and receives a night vision at Beersheba. Joseph is yet alive, and he is the governor over all the land of Egypt. That was the message that he heard, Israel, that day. And when you look at it, you think, I wonder which of those two statements was the more unbelievable before him. That Joseph was yet alive, or that he was the number two man in that great country. He must have thought to himself, did I just hear that correctly? Is this some sort of a sick joke played on me by my sons? Because Joseph can't be alive. I handled with these hands his bloodied coat of many colors. We haven't heard from him for some 22 years. I have mourned for him as a lost son for all this time. And he can't, even if he is alive, he just can't be the ruler over Egypt. Because if he were, surely he would have contacted me before now. And it can't be that he is the ruler over Egypt, because he is the very one who had treated my sons so badly. And how could a godly son of mine be number two in pagan Egypt? The whole thing just doesn't add up. And so we read that Jacob's heart fainted within him because he didn't believe his own ears. He couldn't accept the truth of his son's report, and so the poor man was just hit with this. And when you look at that text and step back a little, you think to yourself, maybe his sons should have told Israel the good news in a better way, because the text reads, at least in our English versions, as if the 11 just blurted it out. Joseph is yet alive, and he's the governor over all the land of Egypt. They're presenting him with a conclusion without working up to it, without laying the groundwork for this stupendous claim. And then you wonder, well, if I had the choice, how would I have introduced this good but completely unexpected news gently? Maybe we would have said, Dad, come over here and have a seat, because I've got something to tell you. It's really good news. Don't worry, it's not awful. It's really, really good news, but it's going to be hard for you to take. And then you take a big breath and you'd say, where do you start the story? Where do you begin? Where do you end? And that's more difficult. But anyway, after this initial statement from Jacob's 11 sons, they told him all the words of Joseph which he had spoken unto them. And I found this intriguing and significant, because we're told here that they didn't present a chronological sequence of events as such. Instead, they provided the background to this stupendous claim by relating Jacob's words to them. And why did they do that? Well, remember, the key point is to prove to Israel that Joseph is alive. Not even to tell him what's just been happening the last 20 plus years, but Joseph's alive. So give the man's words back to his father. And if Jacob hears Joseph's own words, he may well recognize in Joseph's words, with their corresponding behavior, that this bespeaks his own beloved son. And the more suspicious among us may think at this point, maybe this is a way for the 10 brothers to avoid telling their father that they had committed great sin in selling Joseph into slavery into Egypt in the first place. But that can't be the case, because Joseph, and they're going to relate Joseph's words to their father, Joseph actually mentions the sin of his brothers in selling him into Egypt. So here you have to turn back, as it were, in your Bibles to the earlier parts of Genesis 45, when Joseph reveals himself to the 11. Dad, the ruler in Egypt told us who he was. I am Joseph. And he was weeping at the time. And do you know, Dad, what his first words to us after that were? Does my father yet live? The first thing he asked us was about you. And then he told us to come near him, and we were reluctant. We thought he was going to do something awful to us. And he said it again, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. And at this point, Jacob's saying, this is too much for me, I can't take all this. You've told me my son's alive, and now you're saying that you sold him as a slave into Egypt. But he doesn't interrupt, because he wants to hear them out. And then he explained to us, Dad, that God had a purpose in our awful sin, and that we mustn't be too angry with ourselves for it. He told us that 2 years of famine have passed, this awful famine that's hitting us in Canaan and is hitting the Egyptians too. And that, get this, Dad, there's five more terrible years of famine yet to come. But God, Genesis 45 verse 7, but God sent me before you, says Joseph, to preserve you a posterity in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now, it was not you that sent me hither, but God, and he hath made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. So now, Joseph says, tell my father, this is what he wants us to tell you, Dad, thus saith thy son Joseph, God has made me Lord over all of Egypt. Come down unto me and don't tarry. And thou, Joseph continues, thou shalt dwell in the land of Goshen, and thou shalt be near me, thou, father, and thy children, and thy children's children, and thy flocks, and thy herds, and all that thou hast, and there will I nourish thee. For yet there are 5 years of famine, lest you, father, and thy household, and all that thou hast, come to poverty. And then Joseph said to us, because Dad, we had the same trouble believing him as you have now believing us, he said, take a good look at me, you 10 older brothers. You last saw me and recognized me as me when I was 17. Think now, how would I look 22 or so years later? You can see it's me, can't you? Benjamin, you were very small, but you can remember me too. Look at me. I am Joseph. And now you, my brothers, shall tell my father about all the glory that I have here in Egypt that you have seen. And now hurry back and bring my father down into Egypt. And then, Dad, he and Benjamin fell on each other's necks and wept. And then he came over to each one of us in turn and kissed us. And the old man's listening very closely. And later, Dad, Joseph passed on to us the very words of Pharaoh himself, that we were to load up our beasts with grain and return to Canaan and come down to good land, the land of Goshen in Egypt, suitable for our livestock. Now thou art commanded. That's what Pharaoh said. That's what Joseph passed on to us. And that's what we're passing on to you, Dad. Now thou art commanded. This do you. Take you wagons out of the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. And do you know what Joseph's parting words to us were, Dad? Get a load of this. He said to us, see that ye fall not out by the way. He was afraid, Dad, that we might start arguing with each other and blaming each other for our various roles in our huge collective sons. But you were the worst, Judah, because you said he should sell him. Ah, but you were the one, Simeon, who wanted him killed. Ah, but Reuben adding in here, I wanted to try and deliver him. And then Gad saying, well, I was one of the youngest, and I wasn't really in it at all, but since my older brothers had agreed, I felt I couldn't really stand up to you. See that ye fall not out by the way. And you know what, Dad? That's so much like Joseph, because he's our brother, and he knew us from of old. He's the same wise son that you knew. Jacob is being convinced. He understands that the various strands are all fitting together. You know, I never did see Joseph's dead body. All I ever got was his clothes. There was no funeral. All of my 11 sons are in earnest. And they're all saying this to me with a straight face. And why would they be lying about this anyway? How could it possibly be any gain to them? And why would they be telling such a story, which makes them all look extremely bad, because now they're telling me that they sold Joseph as a slave into Egypt? And what they have just told me about Joseph and his behavior, it sure sounds like my son. And then, I always struggled with how this could work out. There were the two dreams that Joseph had that I'd always remember. They stuck with me. Genesis 37 verse 11 even mentions this. I always thought that they were revelations from God. But then I thought I must have been mistaken whenever he died. Could it really be that now, in this strange and mysterious way, that the sheaves and the stars and that the sun and the moon are all going to bow down to Joseph in the land of Egypt? And then came the clincher. When Jacob saw the wagons which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. These were expensive Egyptian wagons. My sons didn't leave with any wagons. Where would they have gotten them if it wasn't that Joseph gave them to him? And they had just told me that Joseph gave wagons to them. And this is just the sort of considerate thing that one would expect from Joseph, who cares for me, his elderly father, and for the women, and for the little ones. This is all too elaborate, too much for a hoax. And so there's a massive change now in Jacob's own subjective, personal condition. In verse 26, when he first heard that Joseph was alive, Jacob's heart fainted, for he believed not. In verse 27, when he believed the good news, the spirit of Jacob revived. He was flagging. He was staggering. It can't be true. And then when he believed, then he revived. His heart and spirit took heart and courage. And this biblical narrative reminds me, beloved, of the two on the Emmaus Road in Luke 24. They were sad. They couldn't make sense of it. There was Jesus of Nazareth, this great prophet of God, mighty in words and deeds. But then he was condemned by the chief priests and crucified. But we had trusted, and it's all dashed, we had trusted that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And yet, it's the third day, and we remember he said something about the third day, something about being raised on the third day. And then there were women who were told by angels at his grave that he was alive. And the men came and they said that they saw an empty grave. And Jesus told them, "O fools, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have written. Ought not Christ to have suffered and then to enter into his glory?" And then, as the clincher, he opened the scriptures to them and showed them from the books of Moses and the Psalms and the prophets that this is the way it had to be. And then it all changed. They believed the objective truth of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that this had happened. And so subjectively, in their own hearts and understanding, they were no longer unbelieving, and therefore they were no longer sad. Now they were believing,
and their hearts burned within them, for they had heard Jesus Christ open the scriptures to them. So in our text, Israel says, it is enough. Joseph, my son, is yet alive. I will go and see him before I die. He's an old man, and he talks quite a lot about dying, doesn't he, Jacob? It is enough. And when he says it is enough, he means, I have had enough proof. I believe you. You don't need to say anything more to convince me. Joseph is alive. And there would be time enough for the 11 later to tell Joseph more about their second Egyptian trip, Genesis 43 through 45, the one I asked you to read last week. How Joseph had invited them to their home for a meal. How, when they left and headed back home, Joseph's cup had been found in Benjamin's sack, and they were all devastated. And how Judah had pleaded with Joseph that he, and not Benjamin, would remain as a slave in Egypt. And later the sons could not only fill in those pieces, but all the pieces in the long, convoluted history, the terrible day in Dothan, with their envy of the first of the favorite, their plan to kill him, then they're selling him to the Ishmaelite and Midianite traders, Genesis 37. Then they could explain more fully, and in part of this sequence, the first Egyptian trip of Genesis 42, and trying to work out what Joseph was doing in it all. And then the second trip in Genesis 43 through 45, and how it must have been that Joseph was a prophet, as Psalm 105 says, and as Genesis 37 proves, because he got the direct revelation from God in the form of those two dreams, it must have been, Dad, that Joseph wasn't being cruel to us by putting us through all this, and indeed you, but he must have been doing this at God's command. And then they would have told him how ashamed and sorry they were at what they did to Joseph, and at what they had put their own father through for the last two decades, and how at times they wanted to tell him what they'd done, but then it would have involved all of them in the guilt, and what could they say, and how it wouldn't be much comfort to their father anyway. But now, Dad, we're glad to tell you the whole truth, and what a massive burden has been lifted from our hearts. And now we believe that the promise given to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob is being fulfilled in us, for we're following the same God and believing the same truth as you are. And doubtless Jacob remembered his own subtlety and deceit when he was a much younger man, and what he, Jacob, did to his brother Esau, tricking him of the birthright and the blessing, and the big lie that he, Jacob, told to his father Isaac when he took advantage of the blindness of his father. And that understanding of his own sin and the grace of God in forgiving him would have enabled Israel to forgive his 10 oldest sons. But for now, the all-consuming thing for Jacob is that Joseph is alive. He's not even concerned so much of what his sons have done. It's just, that's okay, tell me about that later almost, but Joseph's alive. Joseph's alive. That's amazing. And he tells us what he wanted to see. He tells us that he's not interested in Egypt as such and its mighty river Nile. He's not going down as a
tourists to see the great pilgrims and their profound civilization. He's not interested either as such in Joseph's wealth and power. He's not one of these hanger-ons who has a son or a brother or a sister who's really rich and successful and they want some checks given to them. What he wants to see, all the rest is irrelevant, is his own beloved son, because he's a covenant father who loves his child. And so in obedience to the call of Joseph, and with the wagons, Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. Beersheba is a striking place in biblical history, even up unto this point, because it has many hallowed memories with the patriarchs. And remember, these things were passed on from father to son to grandson. Abraham was at Beersheba in Genesis 21. There he made a covenant with Abimelech and Phicol of Gerar, Philistines. There he planted a grove or tamarisk tree, and there we read that he called upon the name of the everlasting God. Genesis 26 has Isaac at Beersheba, making a covenant with Abimelech and Phicol, just as Abraham had done the generation before, only Ahuzzath was with them. And Jacob himself, when he set off for Haran, departed from the camp of his parents, which was at that time at Beersheba. Genesis 28, verse 10. And besides the history of Beersheba, there's what we may call the etymology of Beersheba. That is the origin of the word itself. Beer, the first four letters of Beersheba, in Hebrew means well. A well which was dug by Abraham, Genesis 21, and uncovered by Isaac, Genesis 26, and now used by Jacob and his much enlarged family. And the Sheba in Beersheba, Sheba 7, because Abraham had given 7 lambs to Abimelech when they made that covenant as a sign and remembrance that Abraham had dug this well, and that Abraham should be left alone and not molested by Abimelech or his men. And Sheba not only means 7, but it also means oath, because there were oaths made between Abraham and the Philistines and Isaac and the Philistines. Beersheba, the well of 7, the well of the oath. It's rather strange in the life of Jacob to be talking about Jacob being a place which was named by someone other than Jacob himself. Named by Abraham, renamed by Isaac, because Jacob himself named a lot of places. But the naming of places by Jacob was all on that trip to and from Haran, not on the trip south to Egypt. Remember Bethel, house of God. Remember Galeed or Gilead, the heap of stones, as a witness between Laban and Jacob, and the two wouldn't pass over beyond the heap of stones to do each other harm. Remember Mahanaim, the two camps, Jacob's camp and the camp of the angels. Remember Peniel, face of God, where Jacob saw the face of God in the divine messenger. Remember Succoth, booths
because Jacob made booths for his cattle when he should have been pressing on to get to Bethel and meet with God. Beersheba. Interesting history. Interesting etymology, the origin of the name. And there's some interesting geography with regard to Beersheba too. Significant and simple things. Because Beersheba was at the very southern limit of the promised land. And you know this because of the famous phrase, from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south. That's the whole land, northern and southern extremities. And you remember that when Elijah went to Mount Sinai, wanting to resign his office because he thought it was all a huge failure, how wrong he was, he dropped off his servant at Beersheba, the southernmost boundary. And the second thing geographically about Beersheba, which fits with the first, is that Beersheba is on the route to Egypt. At the very south of the land, on the route to Egypt. And from this perspective too, it was very appropriate for Jacob to stop there, at the southern limit, on the way to Egypt, drink from the well for himself and his family and the livestock, and offer sacrifices there, symbolizing the death of Jesus Christ for the sins of Jacob, Israel, individually and collectively, and to express his gratitude to the God who has led him all his 130 years to this point. Because now he's leaving the earthly Canaan, the promised land, and he's headed to Egypt, and he knows that in this life he will never return. And there, after the sacrifices at that holy place, Jacob received a night vision, which is to say, a dream. Another instance of direct revelation from God to the grandson of Abraham. At Bethel, in chapter 28, he had a revelatory dream with the ladder. In Haran, in Genesis 31, he had a revelatory dream with the speckled, streaky, spotty livestock jumping, mating, and telling him to return to Canaan. In chapter 32, he had revelation in the form of the camp of the angels that met him and the Christ who wrestled with him. In Genesis 35, God spoke directly to Jacob, return to Bethel. And when he was at Bethel, God spoke to him again and reiterated the patriarchal blessing of land and seed in the Messiah. And now it's been a long time since God spoke directly to Jacob. Probably about 30 years. So what does he say here? He starts, Jacob, Jacob. And as those who read the scriptures, you can't but help think of some of the other instances where God spoke to his people by repeating their name. Abraham, Abraham, don't slay Isaac on the altar. Moses, Moses, take off your sandals. You're in holy ground. Samuel, Samuel, I've got terrible things to tell you regarding Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas. Martha, Martha, thou art careful and troubled about many things. There's a time to set down your housework, good as it is, but now you need to listen to me, the Son of God, who's bringing you comforting words from the Lord. Simon, Simon, Satan hath desired to sift you like wheat, But don't worry, I've prayed for you. You will come back to the Lord. And when you're strengthened, encourage your brethren. Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? So God allays Jacob's fear about going down to Egypt. You will recall that Abraham sinned in Genesis 12 when he went down to Egypt during a famine. Jacob doesn't want to do that. You will recall that Isaac was forbidden to go down into Egypt during a famine, Genesis 26. But now God says to Jacob, things are different. You're at a different stage in the working out of my plan. Jacob, Jehovah says, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt. And I've added to all the reasons that Jacob had before for going down to Egypt was this greatest of reasons. Not only did he go there out of desire to see Joseph, and because of the invitations of Joseph, and indeed Pharaoh, and because of the famine, but now he has loud and clear, directly from God, in a dream, this word, go to Egypt, and don't fear to go to Egypt. God is directing his path once again, and he's doing it here at the end of the first day's journey. When he went to Haran, he stopped him at Bethel with a dream and told him, I'll be with you. Go. And I'll be with you when you come back too. And at the end of this first day on his second great journey to Egypt, God says, I'll be with you. Go. But he says nothing about being with him on a return journey, because he knows he's never going to come back. And this is the God who guides the Jacob or Israel, which is the church collectively, and every individual. He guides us by his counsel all the way until he receives us to glory. And you can't look back on and say, see, there were 5 or 6 years in my life when God forgot to guide me, and things went really bad there, and he actually wasn't with me at all. No, you may have backslidden, but he guided you all the way, just as he did with Jacob. And in this dream, God makes promises to Jacob or Israel nationally, which involve Egypt. Verse 3 includes this line, I will there, in Egypt, make of thee a great nation. You're a big family of 70, but you'll only become a nation there in Egypt. And then in the middle of verse 4, I will also surely bring thee up again. And that's a reference not to Jacob as an individual, but to the great nation which has been formed in Egypt. And the one word for that is Exodus. I will also surely bring thee up again. Exodus. And Jacob, who knew all about his father Abraham and Isaac, and therefore knew all about Genesis 15 and the program that God set out there, understood that God is telling him, when Abraham was told that his seed would go down into a strange land, which isn't there mentioned, and become strangers, it must be Egypt. Now I know, it's Egypt, it's not anywhere else. And I'm playing my part in that. And that one day, Genesis 15 said, Israel would come out, Abraham's seed would come out. That's what God's telling me. And he must have put two and two together and realized they're not only going to be strangers in there, but in Egypt, but they're going to be slaves for a while. But even then, I must go down to Egypt. That's the will of God. That's God's covenant, an unbreakable covenant. As well as the promises made regarding Jacob or Israel nationally, God made promises to Jacob individually and personally that involve Egypt.
Verse 4 begins, I will go down with thee into Egypt, just as I was with you when you went to Haran. The end of verse 4 says, Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. And that's a reference to his closing his eyelids in death. He's going to be there when you die. He's going to do this for you. The one whom you thought had died over 20 years ago, he is going to be there when you die. You're not going to lose him, and you're not going to be separated from him. So off they head to Egypt. Jacob, his 11 sons, remember Joseph's already in Egypt, their wives and children, and there were even grandsons there too. Massive numbers of livestock, as God's blessing was working, making them rich. Even in the famine, doubtless they lost a few, but generally they were multiplying with all the Egyptian wagons carrying the old, the really young, the women. And Jacob, who was about 130, and he had that gammy hip anyway. And verses 5 through 27 tell us more about the makeup of Jacob's family. And you'll remember from a couple of or so weeks ago, the really low point with this we end. Jacob's words, Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and ye will take Benjamin away. All these things are against me. And the truth was, Joseph was alive and well and ruling in Egypt. Simeon would shortly be returned. Benjamin would never be taken away from them. And that all these things were for him. And he lived in the darkness for about 20 years. And our calling is to believe. Jacob is an individual. An individual who is also the church. Jacob, Israel. And we are to believe that all things are for us. And that all things work together for good. And to do that over the longer period especially. Amen. Let us pray. Our Father in heaven, bless to us thy word, that we, through the comfort of the scriptures, may have hope. Grant us, Lord, this rich grace. Illumine us and give us strength in our hearts, that we faint not through unbelief. For Jesus' sake, amen.